This is The End User, episode 157 for Tuesday, January 7th, Quadricopter Router. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. Chris, welcome to the future.
We really are in the future. We've got we are in the middle of CES, or I should say the beginning of CES, actually, and we have a proverbial boatload of news to talk about, and I'm pretty excited.
Right. Well, I just meant that it's 2014, which means it's only one year left until hoverboards and self-drying jackets.
Yeah, we'll get there one day. I don't know if that day will be this year, but then again, you are from the future, so you would know better than I would.
That's right. That's why I welcomed you.
But, you know, the Prime Directive and all that, yeah, I guess you can't really share with us, can you?
Right. So, but for the future and for CES, we're doing sort of a different format of the show this week.
Yeah, so instead of breaking down the stories in terms of their importance, like we usually do with the top news and afterburners, we have so much news coming out of early CES here that we just kind of broke it into technology categories. So
Only the end of the first day.
I know. It's crazy. Well, they often do these kind of reveals before the show actually happens. And I know Corey Lyons and Richard Gunther and Josh Pollard from the Digital Media Zone are all down there live and in the flesh at CES. So we've got some the Digital Media Zone boots on the ground there. It's cool to see. So let's just get right into it. Why don't we start off with some HD and TV news? What's Samsung up to here?
All right, so Samsung is definitely stealing the show so far. They have launched a whole new line of enormous 4K LED LCD TVs, the biggest of which is 105 inches.
Oh, God.
The other thing about their new TVs, I don't know if you remember their OLED TVs, the 55-inch models, they're curved. You can't get a flat one. So the whole thing has a slight concave curve, but these new LCD TVs have an optional curve. So it's actually a motor inside the TV causes a spring lever. So you press a button on your remote, and then the TV either goes curved or flat.
Bizarro. So it's bendable, so you can make it either, depending on what your use case is. That's wild.
And they're saying that this creates a 3D type effect without the glasses, which just sounds completely ridiculous to me.
That is kind of ridiculous. You can't make a 3D effect without being stereoscopic, but I could understand them saying that it you know, isn't 3D, but I guess it creates kind of a 3D experience where it's a little more immersive because the screen is kind of folded around you, assuming you're at a good viewing angle.
I can only assume that's what they meant, but we won't be seeing these in stores or in living rooms anytime soon. They haven't announced prices or availability yet for these fancy bendy televisions.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. The TVs that we see at CES are likely never come out, and they're just kind of to show off the technology that is somewhere down the road, maybe in the next, you know, 2-3 years or something, we'll see some application actually come out of this. But yeah, the TVs at CES are almost always just a technology demo.
Right. So another technology demo TV that we saw, but probably one a little bit closer to reality, is Sharp's new Aquos Quattron TVs. They've announced something that I guess they're calling it Quattron. It's going to be somewhere between 1080p and 4K. So they've added subpixels into a regular 1080p TV that are more customizable and more, they create a higher resolution than a 1080p TV, but it's not quite 2K or 4K or anything like that.
Yeah, it almost reminds me of the way Microsoft ClearType works.
Yeah, it's something like that, but it's they've added more actual pixels into the TV.
Right, so I don't know. That's kind of interesting. Do you think? I mean, they just have to go 4K, right? I mean, what's the problem here? Is this going
to
make
a... problem is they're trying to create a stopgap between 1080p and 4K.
Yeah, maybe.
There's no 480. There's hardly any 4K content yet. Nobody's got the players to be able to support that content. And they just want something that is going to be more easily adoptable and probably cheaper.
Yeah, that, I guess that kind of makes sense. You're right. There's not a lot of content. There's a little bit out on YouTube, and we'll talk about some Netflix later with 4K. But yeah, you're right. There's not a lot of content out there, so what's the point? But, you know, we always have to strive to get there. The content will eventually be there, and the question is do you have a display in your living room that can display that content? I also find it a little dubious, and I know we've had this argument before, and we're going to have it again in the future here, but... You know, we had the argument with 720p TVs and 1080p TVs where at a certain viewing distance, the human eye literally cannot discern a difference between 1080p and 720p. And I've got to imagine it's even more true of 4K TV.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and Rennie there in the chat room brings up a good point. 4K is all about upscaling 1080p, just like the early days of 720p, right?
Sure, but...
Oh, sorry, the early days of scaling 720p up to 1080p.
But what equipment do you have that will scale 1080p up to 4K?
Yeah, I guess not a lot for now.
Exactly.
But again, you know, CES is a future-looking conference, and they want to show off everything that they possibly can.
Well, then they should be showing off some sort of 4K content delivery platform.
Yeah, it's coming. It'll be here sometime soon. So,
well, they've been saying that for 2 years now.
So apparently in 2012, and I must have missed this, and maybe we podcast about it, but they also showed off a 85-inch 8K prototype TV. Where was I? I missed that.
Yeah, I think we mentioned it, but that was the same year that Sony and Samsung launched, supposedly launched consumer-ready 4K TVs at 85 inches and up.
Yeah, and they only cost, $10 million or whatever it was.
Well, hey, they're starting to come down.
Yeah, only Tony Stark could have these 4K TVs back then. But yeah, they're coming down. They're coming down in price. Well, so in another interesting turn of events in the TV world, LG has revealed that they are going to use webOS to power its smart TVs. So you kind of saw that coming. We talked a while back about what in the world LG was going to do with webOS, and obviously they were either going to get into the phone business or they were going to use this to power some kind of smart TV. And it looks like we've got the latter, and it looks kind of neat. You know, there's not a lot to talk about the hardware that it's running on, but it looks like very compelling software to be on a TV. I have never met a smart TV platform that I have liked, and this may be the first one that even piques my interest.
It may be, but I just do want to mention that they also do have some new hardware. They have unveiled another flexible TV. Theirs is a 77-inch OLED TV that will presumably have the webOS software on it.
Yeah, so that's pretty exciting. So if I can describe it for just a second, they've got a prototype running. When I saw it on video, it was running webOS on like a laptop just to kind of demo what the interface is likely to look like. And they've got a bunch of little apps on the bottom. They're listing Netflix and Hulu Plus and Amazon and YouTube, you know, all the kind of major video sources that one is likely to consume in a home theater setting. And they've overlaid it on top of a live TV panel. And I got to say, they're kind of transitioning the cards metaphor to having these apps along the bottom in an overlay. And they've got these kind of big full bleed designs when you go into a show or whatever. And they're trying to unify everything together. So the designer of the interface mentioned that they're trying to get it so that you can pull up a show and then watch it wherever, as opposed to pulling up an app and seeing what content is in the app and then watching the content in that way. So, in other words, you would just pull up House of Cards and then the TV would know. It would be smart enough to figure out, oh, that's on Netflix, and now I open the Netflix app and play it. And, you know, oh, that other thing is on Hulu Plus. So it's smart enough to know where to go to get that content. So, you know, I don't know... I don't know how far they are to bearing the fruit of that vision, but if they can execute on that, I would be extremely excited, and it would, like I said, it would blow the pants off of all the other smart TVs that are out there.
Right. I mean, that's sort of what Microsoft's trying to do with the Xbox One.
Yeah, a little bit. I guess, you know, it's not integrated into the TV, although you can do that pass-through thing, which looked kind of interesting. And yeah, it's kind of similar, but, you know, not with, you know, without the gaming. I still think that this interface is going to get tired if you roll it into a TV, right? Because the technology world moves more quickly than you upgrade TVs typically, right? The services that are available move more quickly than TV manufacturers' ability to put the apps in the right place on the TV. So I don't know if they've got some kind of upgrade plan or, you know, what they're thinking about doing in that space. But I feel like it's kind of nice to just plug in a little HDMI device of some sort and be able to swap that out without having to ditch your entire TV.
Right, like a Roku.
Yeah, like Roku.
And except not because Roku is getting into the TV game. So they announced at CES this week that they're going to start integrating Roku into cheap flat panel televisions from 32 to 55 inches. And they're claiming that they are going to sell the TVs themselves at cost and just make money off the advertising from their Roku interface.
Yeah, so I don't mind them trying something, but I cannot imagine bundling in something into the TV like this. Maybe I'm just thinking old school and, you know, maybe I should be a little more forward-leaning, but the TV to me is a place to interface with content. It's not necessarily a place to actually have the software built into it because of its long lifespan. You know, it's like building a smart fridge, you know, that thing. A smart refrigerator would be obsoleted in like 2 years or something. And I feel the same way about TVs. You know, you build something into it and you better have a way of updating it or something or bringing that experience to other people in the market. But I don't know. I think this might be a mistake for them. But, you know, I'm no industry expert, so we'll have to wait and see.
Well, you're probably right. But maybe we're at a tipping point in the TV industry.
It could
be. Maybe we're at a point where the hardware is fast enough and cheap enough to be able to run and maintain all of this software and include software updates over the years so that the software integrated into the TV itself can evolve along with the content that evolves, you know, however it is that you get it, you know, whether you're paying for a cable subscription and maybe Roku can handle your cable subscription and be able to DVR and do things like that inside your TV, or maybe you have a Hulu Plus and a Netflix account and you just want that, you know. But maybe the hardware has gotten to a point where it will not become obsolete before the TV does.
Yeah, I suppose. And again, maybe I'm just being old school here, but I've never seen it done well, so anytime somebody says we're going to do this and it's going to be awesome, I'm going to be a little skeptical. So,
if Apple said we're going to do this and it's going to be awesome,
that would be different, right? And I think maybe Roku is also different because, you know, they've really made wonderful devices over the years, and maybe they can actually deliver on that promise. But I don't trust the likes of Samsung. And I don't know, Vizio and those guys to make a compelling smart TV interface. But, you know, maybe I do trust Roku. I'm undecided on that.
Well, the reason I don't trust any of them is because no one is copying anyone else yet. They're all trying to do it their own way, and no one's figured out the right way to do it yet.
Yeah, nobody's unlocked the magic, as it were.
Yeah, except maybe one of them has, and nobody's realized it yet because half of these things just came out yesterday.
Yeah, maybe it's WebOS. I don't know.
Maybe, probably not.
Yeah, this is WebOS. It's been a strange ride for WebOS, hasn't it?
It's been a very strange ride. I mean, I spent a lot of time with the first Palm Pre, and it was a pretty good device, but it showed its age pretty quickly, and I think WebOS has that. It still has that potential.
Definitely. All right, well, let's move on to something that is definitely looking toward the future here. It's a device called C-Space, and it's a little technology startup that has some prototype device here, and they're envisioning a $99 HDMI adapter. And what's interesting is that it can interface with the Xbox Kinect and Leap Motion gesture controls. So you can swipe around on some of the... you can swipe elements around the screen, kind of like Minority Report. You know, we always talk about Minority Report in this context. But so basically what they're talking about doing is having a little HDMI device whose sole purpose is to be passed through for... metadata and stuff like that. So let's say you're watching, the example they bring up is a game of golf, and you can pull up statistics and things like that over top of the screen while not being part of the actual TV watching interface.
There are so many ways I can imagine for this to be terrible, and only a few of them that would be good. But if it's good, this will probably be really great.
So the device is called In Air, and it can work in two ways. And again, there's a little bit of vaporware involved here. You know, the standard CES vaporware disclaimer is attached to this as well. But so they're doing two things. They're planning to interface with stereoscopic 3D television so that you can have the content kind of floating in front of you, maybe over your coffee table, and you kind of look through it back toward the television. What do you think of that?
It could be interesting, but the same caveat applies.
Yeah, the same. It's got 100 ways to be terrible and one to be successful, doesn't it?
Right.
So the other way that it could work is if you don't have a stereoscopic TV of some kind, then there will just have the 2D overlay on top of the existing programming. So I don't know. It's definitely different. I haven't seen anyone cook something like this up, and I don't know if they can actually execute on it or if it's pie in the sky. But it seems like it's at least worth exploring, and I'm excited to see what they do. And I hope they don't wander off into vaporware land.
All right, well, speaking of vaporware, let's talk about the Avogant Glyph.
Yeah, so the Avogant Glyph, what a strange device. So this is basically a pair of headphones, and it's being billed as your own personal movie theater, because what it can do is not only can it play music, but part of the headband of the headphones can flip down and cover your eyes so that you can watch what would essentially be a giant TV screen, although it's more like a heads-up display, almost like the Oculus Rift or something. So they've got this concept for these headphones that you could kind of lose yourself in and watch a movie by yourself with your earphones and your heads-up display. Is it too wacky?
I sort of like the idea of what they're doing because they're smart in taking this this wearable HDTV idea, which has been around for a while, but is only just getting to the point where it's comparable to a living room HDTV. I mean, they've had them for 5 years or so, these little goggles that plug into your iPhone or something, but they can only broadcast in like 240p per eye.
Ouch.
So now we're a little bit better than that, and they're trying to mix that with like the premium headphone market. So the people that might be buying Beats for another $100 or $200, you can get Beats style headphones that also have an HDTV in the headband. So it's a pretty cool idea, but I'm not sure if people are going to want to buy a $500 pair of headphones with an HDMI cable on them that can just be stolen off your head.
Yeah, and the only market I could see for it is maybe airplanes, would be my best guess. But, this again, the standard disclaimer applies here for this week. The Kickstarter campaign is planned for January 22nd, so that's later in this month. And, yeah, you mentioned it would be $499 is what they're hoping. So, it's a little bit of pie in the sky, but definitely a neat idea if they can execute on it. So, we'll have to wait and see. And I think Canadian Geek brings up a great point there in the chat room. He says, Jordy LaForge. And I don't think anyone wants to look like Jordy LaForge.
Jordy LaForge wearing Beats headphones.
Yeah, that's right. You have to add the headphones on top of that, and just to make you even more geeky looking. All right, well, let's get into what Netflix is planning to offer. What do we got here?
All right, so in addition to their individual plan and their family plan, they are basically offering a new streaming service where you don't get support for their HD content. So it only streams regular SD-type content, which is still pretty good. It's, you know, it's still higher definition than a standard tube television, but it's not going to be any of their new Super HD or even 1080p or 780p, 720p. But it's for $1 a month less. You can sign up for this new service, and you can get that with the individual plan, the standard plan, or the family plan, watching on one screen, two screens, or four screens at the same time, respectively.
Yeah, so that's kind of a nice option. You know, I don't think anyone listening to this podcast would take that option, but I know a lot of people, you know, just don't see the value in quality television. I think they're all patently insane, but I definitely know they're out there, and they say, well, okay, I can deal with no HD. That's okay.
Well, for someone who's only watching Netflix on their smartphone, or for someone who doesn't have a particularly fast internet connection and can't take advantage of that HD content.
Yeah, or maybe you have a bandwidth cap or something like that.
Yeah, those would be three easy use cases for the new Netflix. The non-HD Netflix.
That's a good point. So Netflix is also planning to roll out some 4K content sometime soon. So they're planning to at least put House of Cards into 4K. I also saw that Breaking Bad was supposed to be in 4K. And so you asked where was the 4K content? There it is. It's coming. Don't worry.
Yeah, that's what they've been saying for 2 years.
No, but I think now Netflix is committed, and, you know, particularly with their own content that they've made themselves, they can afford to take a few more leeways and roll out 4K a little sooner. It kind of makes sense, and I'm excited to see it. Now, I don't know if 4K streaming over the web even makes sense. I mean, what is the bitrate going to be like?
I mean, all right. So you would have to have a really fast internet connection. All right, let's say I live in Kansas City. I have Google Fiber. I just got...
I'm jealous.
I just got Samsung's new 4K TV.
Nice.
And
did you bend it forward so it's curved?
Yes, I did. Okay. Do you want me to bend it back?
No. I think it's...
Well, are you going to watch with me? If you're watching with me, I'll bend it back.
Yeah, I guess that's true. If we've got two viewing angles, you might want to bend it around.
Right, okay, I'll bend it back. Okay, but I've got Netflix. We've got the new season of House of Cards. This is the future, of course, Chris. Now, all right, so I've got Netflix. I've got the 4K TV. I've got the gigabit internet. How do I get 4K House of Cards onto my TV?
Well, presumably through Netflix. It would be your only option at this point.
Netflix is a service, not a technology. It's not a box that does 4K.
Right. Okay. So I see what you're saying. So you got to go through some kind of box because presumably the built-in Samsung apps won't be able to handle 4K.
What's the box, Chris?
I don't know. Windows Media Center. How about that? That'll probably handle 4K.
Probably?
Yeah.
You have Windows Media Center. You don't even know?
Well,
this is the problem. This is what I'm talking about. This is what's missing.
Yes, it's true. It's true. I know I have watched 4K over YouTube on my 1080p TV, for what that's worth.
What's the point?
Well, there's currently no point until I get that fancy Samsung TV.
All right. So I guess I need to get, like, the new Mac Pro or something.
Yeah, pretty much. Watch.
So I guess in this scenario in which I have a $25,000 television and... gigabit Ethernet, I can probably afford to run out and grab a Mac Pro so that I can watch things in 4K.
Yeah, you've got to bring a lot more technology to the table. It's going to happen eventually, you know. But yeah, you're right. It's not really accessible right now, but it'll come down the pike in a couple of years here. So, of course, they always say it's 2 years out, right?
I'm tired of people coming out with these new things to be like 4K. That's you can watch 4K on this. No, I can't. How? How can I do that? You're lying. You're making it up.
So Rennie there in the chat room brings up another salient point. Google's got a new codec out. It's for 4K, and it runs at 15 megabits per second. So that might breathe some new life into your
All right, cool. So I don't need gigabit Ethernet. That's great, because I don't have gigabit Ethernet, nor do I have any of those other things.
You'll probably still need a good 50 megabit line or something.
Yeah, at least, just to handle the latency.
All right, well, let's move on to our second section of the CES special show here. We're going to lump laptops and tablet devices together here. And
along with a few other computer-oriented things.
Yeah, general computing, I guess we'll call it.
All right, as last time, let's give Samsung the top billing.
Yeah, Samsung's got it here. They've got a new Galaxy Tab Pro. They've got a 12-inch tablet. Taylor, a 12-inch tablet. They've got a 10-inch tablet and an 8-inch tablet that they are unveiling here at CES. And I got to say, I mean, I know the standard laptop is like 13 inches or so, but 12 inches to hold in your lap, it seems like a bit excessive. But then again, I'm sure it's just like phones where they will get a little bit bigger and we'll just get used to it. So the one interesting thing that is common to all three of these devices is their 2560 by 1600 pixel screen. So that is kind of unique. Otherwise, you've pretty much got the same stuff that you would expect from Samsung. You know, it's an Android tablet, and it's got modern hardware underneath. So kind of neat stuff, but nothing groundbreaking there.
All right, so in addition to the new Galaxy Tab Pro line, they're also launching a concurrent Galaxy Note Pro line, which is basically all the same hardware, but it comes with a stylus.
Yeah, cool. So, again, nothing groundbreaking here, but good to see them iterate and iterate and iterate. The devices always get better, so good thing to see. So,
the Note Pro is only a 12.2-inch tablet for now.
Right, right. So Lenovo is also unveiling a new X1 Carbon, which is a kind of workhorse Ultrabook kind of computer. And it's basically just a small iteration on that. So if you like the old ThinkPad brand and you are a fan of Lenovo, you'll probably want to have a look at that. And a little more interestingly, perhaps, they've released a ThinkPad 8-inch version. So this is a 8.3-inch tablet with a 1920 by 1200 display and a quad-core Intel chip, which is Bay Trail, a little bit. That's going to be pretty darn fast there. And I don't know, that seems pretty nice. A 8-inch quad-core Windows 8.1 tablet.
Yeah, 8 inches seems pretty small to us, but I bet you it'll sell well in certain markets.
Yeah, and the X1 Carbon I mentioned, that's going to be a $1,300 computer. It's got 9-hour battery life, which is kind of nice. It's only 0.68 inches thick. It's a 14-inch screen, and it looks like a pretty darn nice laptop from what I can see. And they still have that darn nubbin in the middle of the keyboard that I will never understand.
Oh, I love that nubbin. That's my favorite thing about Lenovo's, or about ThinkPads in general.
Yeah, they have single-handedly decided that the nubbin is a good idea.
It was my favorite method of control for flight simulators back in the day.
All right, so if you want to play Microsoft Flight Simulator, then I guess the Carbon X1 is your new laptop.
All right, but from Lenovo, you can also pick up the new Yoga tablets. These are their Windows 8 tablets that are laptops, but fold 360 degrees around to become tablets. And the Yoga 2 is available in 11 and 13-inch models, starting at $529 and weigh about 3 pounds and be 2/3 of an inch thick. And I'm surprised to see that they both come with with standard spinning hard drives as the storage option. Of course, you can upgrade to a solid state drive, but they really should be focused more on solid state full time, even at the $500 price point. So that's a little weird to me. But otherwise, these seem like solid computer tablet hybrids.
Yeah, you got to think of it
as solid as the original Yogas were, and probably a halfway decent compromise between a laptop and a tablet.
Yeah, you got to think of this as an Ultrabook first and a tablet second, though. I wouldn't buy this because it's a tablet, but it is kind of neat that it can flip over and do tablety things sometimes.
True. So, in case that wasn't enough laptops for you from Lenovo, they're also launching the Z40, the Z50, the Y40, and the Y50. I would say these are the most vanilla of their laptops that they've announced today. So, I barely even want to mention these.
Hey, it's a 14-inch laptop with a 1080p screen and a Core i7 underneath with 16 gig of RAM. What else do you want? But yeah, I agree. The design is a little lackluster, but it's meant to be lackluster. These devices are more or less for business computing. So the line of the four devices there kind of span the performance gap. And if you are interested in more of these Lenovo laptops, you'll want to go ahead and look in the show notes. But yeah, they've got a full kind of suite of laptops in laptop tablet hybrids, and they've been pumping a lot of news into CES, and this is one minor little bit of it, right?
Right.
So let's see. Yes, this is the last Lenovo story. They announced a lot of devices at CES. It's kind of crazy. So they've also got the Mix 2 is the other device that we haven't quite talked about, and this is a little bit, it's kind of like the Yoga 2, but it's not meant to be that kind of ultra slim kind of device. It's kind of like it kind of flips around in the same way, but it doesn't flip all the way back, and it's meant to be a little bit cheaper. So it's got a $699 price tag, and it's just kind of a different category than the Yoga 2. A little bit confusing to have all of these options, isn't it?
Yes, I'm starting to get very confused. Did we already talk about the Flex 14D and the Flex 15D?
No.
Okay, so those are two more new laptops from Lenovo.
It's getting crazy now.
Could they just at least space it out a little bit? Do they have to introduce them all at CES?
Maybe their strategy for the media was to flood the market with information. No, but I'm sure there's some truth to this just being kind of a, let's throw some stuff out there and kind of experiment. And, you know, we've talked about this before in the kind of Windows 8 era and how Windows 8 is a beast that nobody really knows what to do with, and people kind of hate it because of that. And, you know, I don't know if in the end the tablet interface is going to be successful, but Microsoft is going to push it, and manufacturers are going to experiment by making a ton of different kinds of devices where you can flip the screen around and that kind of thing. And, you know, eventually I think we're going to have some notion of, okay, this worked and this did not work, and, you know, this is what we've kind of settled on, similar to how laptops and their clamshell design have kind of evolved over time.
Sure, that makes sense. It's just it's been more than a year, and nobody can decide still what a Windows 8 computer should look like.
Yeah, and there's a ton of them out there, and I think the Yoga 2 has hit a pretty decent mark, and I think the devices where you can rip the screen off have hit a pretty decent mark, and I think somewhere between those two, I think we've got our kind of final form factors, but that won't stop people from experimenting. But you remember the Dell that flipped the screen around the bezel of the device? I mean, that clearly was kind of gimmicky, and I don't know. I think we have kind of settled on those two devices, even though everybody's still experimenting.
I don't think we have yet seen the final form factors of Windows 8.
Yeah, maybe we haven't. Maybe there's something out there that will break the mold and make sense in a way that none of us have ever thought of.
All right. Well, speaking of these form factors, we have more, plenty more, just in this category. So Asus is launching their Transformer Book Duet, which is going to be a laptop with a detachable screen that runs Windows 8 and Android.
And that's just crazy. I understand the need to go between a mobile operating system and a full-fledged operating system. But do you think consumers really want to switch between Windows and Android, or do you think they think that's too complicated? I'm not sure.
I don't know. I would want to see how this thing works, but it seems like they are trying to do a dichotomy where you have a fully functional laptop running Windows 8, and then you can just remove the screen, and then you have a tablet running Android.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think that, I guess people deal with it when they pull their phone out of their pocket. But I don't know. Would you really want it all in one device? I'm not quite so sure. And, you know, I guess Android, as it is, does hold the app advantage. You know, there's a lot of apps available for Android that aren't available for Windows 8. But I would just think that you would want a device that just runs Windows 8 and, you know, doesn't. Windows 8 doesn't need Android by its side. It just seems a little strange to me.
What I'm saying is that I think Asus is trying to do something which has been attempted before, but not very well, as far as I've heard.
Sure.
That you buy this one device and you get two fully functional devices, right? You buy the laptop,
and then you pull
the screen off the laptop, and you can take the screen and just go with that and then have an Android tablet.
Yeah, I suppose so, because a lot of people must have a Windows laptop for doing serious things and then a Android tablet for more consumption-based kind of activities. So, yeah, I could see it. I could see the need, I suppose. But ultimately, I think it's got to be one or the other. But, you know, maybe we've got a stopgap device in this. And it does look pretty awesome for what it's worth.
Yeah, it does. And I think it if it's done well, it could be a really great piece of hardware. The thing that would be most disconcerting to me is you're taking that screen off and all of a sudden you have a completely disconnected operating system, right? The Windows and the Android are completely separate. They're one device, but as soon as you pull that screen off, you're in a completely different environment.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit of a, almost no matter how they solve those integration problems, there's just going to be a, I mean, you think moving from the Windows desktop to the Windows 8 start screen to be jarring. How about just moving completely to Android?
That's going to be
even more jarring. Yeah,
right. And there's no connection between the file systems, so all of the files that you had on Windows 8, they're in the cloud, but otherwise they're not available.
All right, so let's get into some Acer news. They've released a new Chromebook, but they've changed the color so that they've got a white shell on it. But this is the C720, which is a Chromebook with a touchscreen on it. I'm pretty sure we talked about this on the End User when the original version was coming out. And
yeah, we did talk a little bit about that.
And I really kind of liked the way their Acer Iconia tabs have been looking. They've got two new models. One's called the A1A30 and one's called the B1720. And man, do they have snappy names.
I don't know. I don't see it. I don't see anything snappy about this except maybe the price.
Yeah.
Which is the A1A30 is $179 and the B1720 is only $129.
Exactly right. The price, it's a lower-end Android device that has a lower-end price to match. So some people are going to be interested in that. You know, some more price-sensitive consumers will probably like this kind of device. So, and strangely, they've also got an Android all-in-one desktop called the Acer TA272HUL, the snappiest name yet. But hear me out for a second. This is a 27-inch display that is 2560 by 1440 and runs Android 4.2 Jelly Bean with an NVIDIA Tegra quad-core processor and, you know, has the kind of Android accoutrement that you're used to. What do you think about Android as a desktop operating system?
I think this is the best looking of the devices that they have come out with here. And I think Android as a desktop solution is a terrible idea. But if this 27-inch screen can function competently as a media center / mobile personal organizer, I think it could be a very successful device.
Yeah, I don't know about terribly successful, but it is interesting, if nothing else. People are upset about the Windows UI of Windows 8, and this is just going whole hog. You know, there is no desktop. Maybe that's what Windows 8 should have been in the first place, but there's no way that this Android desktop could get everything done that I need to get done, but I'm sure there's a subset of people out there that might be interested in this kind of thing.
Well, Windows 8 is it's definitely a full-featured, almost a power user type of desktop, right? Windows is sort of made mostly with power users in mind, whereas this would be a very casual thing, somebody who just wants web browsing, calendar, email, not much more than that, and maybe want to watch a few movies as well.
Yeah, I suppose so. So, I don't know, for some subset of people it might make sense, but again, probably the people that are listening to this podcast probably aren't the target market for an Android desktop. They probably need a little bit more power under the hood. Although I shouldn't disparage Android, you know, it's a pretty full-fledged operating system. It's just that, you know, you can't run a database on it yet. And I know, since I say that you can't run a database on Android, someone's going to email us and say, oh yes you can, here it is, you know. But so anyway, an interesting looking device from Acer. So let's move on into Vizio. They have refreshed their line of laptops, and I'm disappointed to see that they're getting rid of their 14-inch thin and light. I remember being on the podcast and really loving the design that Vizio had put into their then-current crop of laptops. So what they're doing is they're paring back. They're going to have a 15.6-inch thin and light laptop and a 24-inch all-in-one desktop. And
yeah, I'm a little bit disappointed with this direction as
right?
Well. They should try to differentiate themselves by going into the, you know, they shouldn't go towards the middle.
Yeah, I because isn't a 13.3-inch laptop like the big middle of the market? It just seems very strange for them to ignore that that at least what I think. I'm not sure. You know, I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but I've got to imagine that those between 12 and 14 inch laptops are the vast majority of laptops that are sold. But I don't know.
I don't have any data, but I don't think that's necessarily the case. But it would seem to me that Vizio's laptops are just not selling at all how they were expecting, and so they're not quite sure what to do at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, that kind of makes sense. But I still do love the design of both of these devices. If you want to have a look at these things, you got to go into the show notes and click through on the link to The Verge we've got. But if nothing else, these are absolutely two beautiful computers, aren't they?
They are, yeah. And Vizio has always made very good-looking machines of questionable quality. And they've put a lot of work in them, so I want to see them make a really outstanding machines comparable to the level of research that they've done to make them. And so they look great, and if they perform great, then that'll be good too. All right, so one last story here. It's not a laptop or a tablet. It's a router. Linksys, who's now owned by Cisco, is reviving their classic WRT router, which was the market-leading router for a very long time, but when Cisco originally bought Linksys, they neutered it. They took out a lot of the customizability that people had discovered by hacking it over the years. Now they are making a new version. They're sort of doing a new beetle of the WRT router, except this one is a lot fancier, a lot more expensive, and built from the ground up to be open source. So it's $300.
Yeah, it's kind of neat, a little homage to the past. And I'm glad that they're making a router that looks like a Cylon.
I'm glad that they're making a router that isn't terrible.
Yeah, so it looks like it almost looks like a quadcopter, doesn't it?
A little bit. It has four antennas that are each on separate hinges, but they are not going to make this thing fly.
All right, Taylor. So I have a mission for us, and we should contact Linksys about this immediately. They need to make a flying router, clearly. That's clearly what they need to be doing.
Clearly.
So I look forward to Linksys's, or I look forward to a Linksys quadricopter router that can fly around the room and perhaps follow me so I get the best wireless signal possible.
And with that, I think we should turn our attention to phones and the wireless industry, which have certainly been very present at CES. But starting with that, AT&T has made an announcement about their limited data plans for wireless customers. They're allowing content providers to sponsor the data being used by customers on AT&T phones and tablets. So if you download a certain app or go to a certain website or watch a certain video, it won't count towards your data cap because the content provider chooses to pay for that data instead of you. And so it's invisible to you. It just doesn't count towards your cap.
Interesting. So more options on the AT&T front. Is this something that interests you, or are you all set on your plan?
I mean, it interests me, and I don't have an opt-out of this. I'm an AT&T customer. This just becomes part of my plan by default. I have no way of knowing what data I'm paying for and what data someone else is paying for. That worries me for two reasons. One, this clearly goes directly against net neutrality. But the other reason I'm worried is that I'm being offered something for free. And I've come to abide by the internet saying if the product you're using is free, then you're not the customer, you're the product.
Right. Yeah, that is
right?
A little troublesome.
So I'm worried that they are going to start taking a lot more personal data out of these interactions. But I'm on AT&T, so I don't really have a choice. And on the face, all that happens is my data use goes down, which is great because last month I went over my cap and I had to pay an extra $10 for another gigabyte of data usage.
Yeah, so it could be a good thing for some people, I guess. But it is a little troublesome, isn't it? All right, so let's move on to a device from Asus called the Zenfone, which is a little bit odd in the industry. It is a there's really three devices here. They've got the Zenfone 4, the Zenfone 5, and the Zenfone 6, which all represent the amount of inches the screens are across. It runs a version of Android. It's 4.3, and they've got a special skin on top that is supposed to make things simpler, but I don't know. We'll see about that. You know how I feel about skinning Android. So anyway, that's called Zen UI, and the thing that makes this a little bit interesting is that they're actually running on Intel Atom processors and not ARM processors that most Android devices are on. So that's quite a bit different. And as you would expect, as you go up in size, the phones get a little bit bigger. The bottom phone has a screen of 800 by 480 with a 1.2 gigahertz Atom chip. And the Zenfone 5 and 6 have 720p screens with a slightly faster processor. So,
which is great. That's important as opposed to Samsung's new Tab Pro line, which all have the same resolution, even though they're vastly different sizes.
Yeah, so it's hard to say. These things aren't going to light the world on fire, but interesting, very, very interesting to see the Intel chips go into some phone from some manufacturer. And even more interesting, perhaps, is that it's Asus, a traditional PC and tablet manufacturer, as opposed to a phone maker. So maybe they're a little more familiar with integrating with Intel hardware.
Yeah. So notable absence, none of these phones have LTE, so none of them will be on high-speed wireless networks, but they are very cheap. The Zenfone 4 is only $99 with no contract, and the 5 and 6 are only $149 and $199.
All right, so let's get into one of my favorite devices here. Not that I have one, because they don't support Windows Phone, but the Pebble Watch has unveiled a new smartwatch that is going to be $249, and it is a kind of classic-looking steel watch band that has the same kind of Pebble interface on it. And that's going to be shipping on January 28th, and that seems pretty cool.
Yeah, it's the exact same hardware in a much nicer case. So the whole thing is stainless steel. The watch bands are interchangeable, both with the regular Pebble and the new Pebble. But this is you could get a steel chain link watch band with this Pebble, and it wouldn't look out of place. It makes the same watch look and feel a lot nicer.
Yeah, definitely a welcome option to have opposed to the what do they have? They had black and red earlier, and I think they had a leather band option. So I'm looking forward to smartwatches hitting the masses. I'm eager to see what developers can do with these things.
Yeah, me too, because the Pebble API will be coming out in the next few weeks, as we mentioned last month.
Yeah, so exciting to see what people will actually do with it. These things are starting to get a little bit more matured, and we'll see what actually happens with these things. So Lenovo will not leave us waiting from earlier in the show, and they've released four new phones. I'll talk about the high-end one only here, and if you want...
Only four phones?
Yeah, they had, I believe they had a total of 87 laptops and four phones at CES this year. So definitely out in force this CES. So I'll only mention the top of the line here. This is the Lenovo Vibe Z is what it's called, and it looks like a pretty nice device for what it's worth. It's 5.5 inches. It's got a 1080p display. We've got 2 gigs of RAM on board, a 13-megapixel camera, a pretty healthy 3,000 milliamp hour battery, and it runs Android 4.3, and it's going to retail for $550. So I don't know if we're going to see this in the U.S. or not, but this is Lenovo's time to show off their wares, and indeed, they will show off their wares, Taylor.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so the Motorola Moto X is now only $399 without a contract, which is a major price drop and a permanent price drop. And the Moto G, the cheaper cousin of the Moto X, is finally launched on Verizon.
So the makers of Gorilla Glass, Corning, they are making a new version of Gorilla Glass, and that's going to have an antimicrobial layer on top of the glass. So that is very, very interesting, because phone screens get absolutely disgusting after other people, you know, borrow the phone for a little while and swipe their grubby paws all over the screen. And people may not like to admit it, but pretty much everyone has grubby paws. So I think an antimicrobial screen is definitely a good thing to see.
Yeah. So what they did was add ionic silver particles into the glass production. So it's built into the glass, and it's permanent. There's a permanent antibacterial effect.
All right, so let's get out of the mobile phone space and into a segment that we usually don't talk a lot about, and that is the automotive industry. There's been a few developments in the automotive industry. And I think my favorite is this wacky new kind of car. It's called the Toyota iRoad. And we've got a link in the show notes to The Verge, where you can see a video of it actually driving around. But what it basically is a hybrid between a motorcycle and a car. It's got three wheels. And the thing that's a little interesting about it is that it leans like a motorcycle. So there is one wheel in the back and two wheels in the front, and it's basically a size made to fit one person driving in a city context. And that thing, the wheels actually tilt to the side when you go and lean to the side, kind of like a motorcycle. So you get to kind of you get to lean to the side, and the whole car tilts sideways, and you kind of lean into the turn like you would with a motorcycle. And I don't know if we'll ever see this in the United States, but it looks like a very cool concept to me.
Yeah, it does seem pretty cool, and I swear that I've seen concepts like this before, but This does seem like a new generation of it, and possibly closer to actual production.
Yeah, I know we had talked about one where the wheels turn sideways so that you could parallel park it without actually parallel parking. You would just pull up and then turn the wheels sideways and then literally move the car sideways into the space. But yeah, this is a little bit different than that. It's less of a car and more of a motorcycle in that sense, although it's definitely an enclosed vehicle. But very cool dream work from Toyota. So I'd like to see this kind of stuff.
All right, and another concept car that Toyota announced, but they claim that they're going to be able to bring this one to market in 2015, is an actual viable fuel cell vehicle. Now, a fuel cell car, they run on hydrogen, and so you need to have hydrogen pump stations. But otherwise, they work basically as electric cars. You can create a hydrogen electricity conversion system that takes the hydrogen, runs it through a battery engine type of system, converts it to pure electricity and pure water. And so this is basically an electric car that doesn't charge off the grid. It charges purely on hydrogen. And they are claiming that they have not only developed the car and being able to bring it to market at competitive prices, but that they also have a planned hydrogen delivery system that they claim can be ready to go in about a year.
Yeah, the fuel cells have been around a long time in cars, but the problem has always been, how do we get the fuel around? And, you know, it's not as simple. You can't just, like, pour water into this thing and be on your merry way with fuel. You know, it's not quite how it's going to work. And that was kind of the dream, is that you would, or at least that was the hyperbole that was being sold, was that you would eventually be able to just pour water into the car and have water come out. But, you know, that really hasn't panned out. And we've had a lot of fuel cell vehicles in the past, and the problem has always been the fuel delivery mechanism. So I'd be curious to see what their solution for that is.
Right, and they claim that they have the system. It's easy to make a concept car that takes hydrogen, but to actually design a viable car that will be usable by the majority of people and fit within their price range and be able to fill it up. So they have to think about, how big is the tank going to be for the hydrogen? What's the range on this car? But overall, hydrogen is a more energy-dense storage system than either a lithium-ion battery like in electric cars or gasoline like in regular cars. So this has the potential to be a much more efficient transportation system than either of those two, but it takes a lot of thinking. Not only in designing the car, but in redesigning the whole system by which we fill cars. And also figuring out where we're going to get that hydrogen. Because although it is the most abundant element in the universe, it is not that easy to come by on its own on this planet.
So maybe we can forget the hydrogen and get energy from the sun.
Yeah, and that's Ford's idea. Although this is not a purely electric car, they have come up with a new concept called the C-Max Energy Plug-in Hybrid. It is a plug-in hybrid, as the name suggests. So it has an internal combustion engine as well as an electric motor in there. And then it has solar panels on the roof. But if anybody has ever seen a true solar car, they are extremely lightweight. They only fit one person. They are covered in solar panels to the point where they're actually larger than a normal car, and they are not very fast, but they can move thousands of miles with only the power of the sun. So Ford had a different idea. They say, okay, first, let's put a gas engine in it to make sure that nobody runs out of solar panels or solar power, you know, if it's the middle of the night or it's cloudy or whatever reason. And second of all, let's put solar panels on the roof of it. But we know that's not going to be enough solar panels, so let's plug it in. But then they had this genius idea where, what if we just improve the performance of the solar panels on the roof? So the car comes with its own little magnifying glass carport. So you park the car under this little carport thing, and it uses a lens to concentrate light from the sun onto these solar panels, which is just – it's such a simple idea. It's amazing that that no one's thought of it before. But it's obviously not a very effective idea because it's not going to allow the car to run purely off solar power. But it still makes it charge much more efficiently off only solar power without added weight and expense of more solar panels on the car.
Well, yeah, and you got to take a step back and say, okay, well, maybe it's okay that we don't have a 100% solar-powered car that is in this kind of mass market body. You know, we've got the crazy super light solar cars that, you know, race across the country or whatever. But I mean like a, you know, a Civic. And but what you can do is you can just augment the charging from the grid, right? It's not an all or nothing gain.
You can, exactly. And that's what I like about this. I mean, I think it's very clever, and it's a proof of concept that could go in a lot of different directions. Either way, it makes a more efficient car. So GM is adding a new feature to their line in 2015. It's not going to make the car any faster or more efficient, but it will let you have Wi-Fi in your car because they are going to add an LTE connectivity option built into the car across their whole line.
You knew that this was going to happen eventually, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the car manufacturers have been waiting smartly for the most part because the cellular technology wasn't there. It wasn't cheap enough. It wasn't fast enough. And they were worried it was going to become obsolete and that they were smart to do that. Obviously, TV manufacturers are not thinking about the obsolescence of the electronics they're putting into their TVs, not as hard as the car manufacturers are. But now they're sort of there. It's pretty cheap and easy to get LTE, and it's usually fast enough. So why not put it into a car?
Well, so you think that a TV is a long-lived purchase. How about a car? How fast is that software going to get obsolete? And that's one of the interesting things that this enables. So, you know, previously, if you wanted to update, you know, I've never had a car that has a software interface built into it like this with a touchscreen and all that and apps and everything. But you could imagine that some of the cars that have these platforms built into them have gotten obsoleted relatively quickly compared to the lifespan of the vehicle. And what if this thing has its own little 4G connection, you know, that really enables a whole world of delivering updates to the software platform within the vehicle. And, you know, the radio app and all that kind of stuff that's actually built into the dash. So, yeah, that's kind of a neat little world where this thing will just kind of update itself. And hopefully they are able to keep up with you know, everything that's happening.
Yeah, but I'm just imagining the car buyers of 2020 making fun of the owners of these 2015 cars. Oh, wow, your car only has LTE? Wow, that's crazy 4G, bro. I bet you have to drive your car yourself, too.
Yeah, we have quantum wireless. There is no speed. It's infinite.
Well, that would be teleportation.
Yeah.
You think we'll have teleportation by 2020?
See, that's what I was thinking. You know,
maybe you should be the futurist prime then.
It's cute that you have a car. We just teleport everywhere now. And I don't really care about the apps on your car because we just teleport. We have the ultimate app.
That would be the ultimate app.
Oh, yes. Oh, it certainly would. Okay, Taylor. Well, take a big breath. We are pretty much out of the CES thicket of news. And it was a lot of fun to discuss, though. But let's get into the tip of the week. And you've got us covered with one here. What do we got?
Sure. I just got a new Apple TV. I got the third generation Apple TV.
Oh, nice.
I used to have access to a second generation Apple TV, but I never found this feature. I don't know when they added this feature, but any infrared remote, you know, anything with a programmable infrared interface can be used to control the Apple TV. So you just tell the Apple TV what buttons you want to mean the Apple TV buttons. There are only six of them: up, down, left, right, select, and menu, and it learns them. And that's it. You never have to worry about losing an Apple TV remote again, because It's very small. The remote that comes with it. It's very small. It's basically designed to fall between couch cushions.
Yeah. In fact, I swallowed one of those remotes, and it was not pleasant.
No, I can imagine that would be not very pleasant.
No, I definitely
didn't
do that.
The plastic one or the metal one?
The metal one.
Oh, that's way worse.
No, I definitely didn't do that. But this is amazing. I would have never thought to invert this. Usually you think, well, the remote learns the codes to control the thing. Not the thing learns the controls for the remote. And if more manufacturers did this very thing, I think we'd be a lot better off, wouldn't we?
We would, yeah. I mean, it would be kind of complicated for certain remotes, but like if you could do this with Roku, it would make using Roku much easier for some people. But they've at least on the Roku 3, they've decided to go Wi-Fi, so you can't do this.
Yeah. Right, yeah, it's not infrared. But anyway, what a great idea. So good on Apple for that one. So
that was a very surprising tip for me, so I thought I would share it, just in case anybody with an Apple TV didn't already know. Or if you have a Roku and you're unsatisfied, get an Apple TV. Or just get a Chromecast. It's way cheaper.
So what is our app pick of the week? We've got music streaming on tap.
Right, so this is, I guess it's more of a social network than an app, but it's a new web app called... Wide, I think it's Wide, WHYD, and they have just announced.
I believe it's
public availability.
It's pronounced Wide.
It was invite only beta, and now it's they've opened up their enrollment, and it's sort of a music based social network, but it's more than that. It's basically any music or video content you can collect and share into playlists and share them with other people on the network and curation engine. So you can curate and investigate streams of this other content and look at other people's playlists, and it'll have recommendations for you. It's hard to explain, but it's really simple to use. So now that it's open and free, might as well give it a shot. I haven't had a chance because I only found out about it today.
Yeah, and I've only found out about it since you put it in the show notes. So we'll have to give this a shot and see what it looks like, and maybe come back and talk about it a little bit later. But yeah, looks like a pretty cool option.
Will you add me on Wide, Chris?
Yeah, I can add you on Wide.
Okay, good.
So from the app pick of the week to what location to make your perfect French fries in. And apparently that is... further out in the solar system than you may be comfortable with. What is happening?
I do not understand what is happening. I'm very confused by this, but it is definitely a thing that has happened. Some researchers at the Aristotle University of Thessaloniki in Greece were wondering about how to make the perfect double fried potato stick. Now, I've read a lot about the creation of French fries and how to make the perfect one. And I've debated with people because there are a lot of differing opinions. What kind of fat do you cook it in? How long do you cook it? Do you parboil it first? How thick do you cut it? How well should it be cooked? How crispy should it be? How should the potato taste on the inside? What sort of potatoes should you use? There are a lot of variables, but the variable that I never would have thought about changing is gravity. But that's what these guys decided to figure out. It wasn't enough to mess with the variables that you can mess with here on Earth. They thought, what if you change the gravity? How would you get better French fries? I don't think they tested it. I'm not sure. But they claim to have found that the perfect gravitational point for making the ideal French fries is somewhere on the order of Jupiter. They say about three times Earth's gravity would be the ideal condition for cutting potatoes into sticks and then dipping them in hot oil.
Bizarro.
I don't know how or why they came up with that, but they did. And it's published in Food Research International. It's an academically cited journal, and I haven't read the whole thing, but I'm very intrigued. And now I really want to try French fries on Jupiter.
Yeah, forget about all that. I just want to try some. So I'm not sure we're going to get Jupiter French fries in our lifetime. See, what we'll have to do is send a robot up to Jupiter, have it make fries, and then fly back to Earth, and then we can have Jupiter fries.
Chris, French fries, rule number one, you have to eat them right away.
It's true. It's true. So we'll have to wait for the teleportation.
They get soggy. It's all about the moist, fluffy inside and the crispy, dry outside.
So we'll have to wait for the teleportation we were talking about earlier.
That's right. As soon as we get teleportation, then we'll definitely go to Jupiter and make French fries. That's a given.
All right, so
I have another kicker story this week, and it's also from the future. And it's actually from the same journalist at CNET, Eric Mack. He loves writing about this stuff. I would say he's probably their futurist prime over at CNET.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
All right. So this is not even an article, really. It's he calls it a two-part piece of speculative fiction, envisioning life in a world in which technologies that have emerged in 2013 have all gone mainstream. So he writes this piece of fiction that takes place 10 to 20 years in the future, and he sort of imagines his daily life. And he starts off with he can't commute on his Hyperloop because there's been a depressurization event. So he's late for work because he can't take the Hyperloop.
And hijinks ensues?
Something like that.
So I've got to imagine.
Anyway, I won't read the whole thing on the air because this is a pretty long show already. But you should definitely check out our show notes or CNET.com and read Eric Mack's article. The Hyperloop is down and I'm late for work.
Yeah, and we'll have a link in the show notes. So go over there to the digitalmediazone.com and have a look for our show notes. But I've got to imagine it's far into the future and we're still commuting to work in such a pedestrian way. There's got to be a better way.
Yeah. Chris, do you think... Oh, wait. So the Hyperloop is pedestrian?
I'd imagine... What did he say what year this was? Or is this just unnamed future?
10 to 20 years in the future.
Yeah, 10 to 20 years.
Well, you're predicting teleportation in 6 years. So yeah. I guess that is pretty pedestrian.
No. Teleportation's next year, my friend.
Oh, okay. That wasn't in Back to the Future too. Do you think we'll still be using Twitter next year?
Next year? I don't know. Technology moves quickly. I'm going to use Identica from now on.
Okay. So if someone wanted to get in touch with you this year, Chris, how would they do that?
I think the best way to reach me would be to bring me some Jupiter fries. And when you've got the Jupiter fries, you can tweet at me. My handle is at Chris Hale Barnes. And Taylor, if someone were to try to get at you, what's your Twitter handle? How would they tweet at you?
Chris, if I had Jupiter fries, you would not be the first place I go. top five, but no, I'd go somewhere else first. I would eat the fries first. And then if I had extra fries, yeah, you're still top five.
Well, so what's your Twitter handle? You got to hand it out there.
I got to hand it out. What, do I have to make cards made for my Twitter handle?
Yeah, you have to get, and all it's allowed, it just says your Twitter handle on it. It can't say any other information.
Actually, I really want that now. I really want to have these cards that only say at TaylorPhone.
Here's my business card, and it just says at TaylorPhone in Helvetica.
I love it.
Classy.
Yeah, I'm going to do that.
All right, well, so that will do it for this week for CES. And, of course, we'll be back next week with a lot more CES news as the CES week wears on. Like I said before, we've got three people from the digitalmediazone.com over there at CES in Las Vegas. That's Corey Lyons, Josh Pollard, and Richard Gunther. They're all over there. So keep tuned to the digitalmediazone.com. We've got a bunch of blog posts, way more than we normally have on the site. And just stay tuned for all of the CES coverage that we're going to have. And again, we will be back next week, as per usual, to cover it in podcast form. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And of course, you can find more information, including our show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts you should have a listen to: Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, The Movie Podcast, and the latest Home On. You can also send us some feedback. We've got an email here. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can tweet us both. We are at @theenduser. Join us in the chat room live as we record the show Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Moss.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.